Hi, so good afternoon. This is Chair Rena Moran. Pursuit of House Rule 10.01. I call this remote meeting of the Health and Human Service Policy Committee to order. The committee legislative assistant will take the roll call for attendance. Mute it this time, or you can mute yourself until we call your name to say aye. I'm going to pass over to
Representative Moran. Oh, okay.
Here.
Representative Morrison.
Present.
Representative Keel. Representative Keel. Representative Albright. Representative Albright.
Good afternoon.
Representative Backer. Representative Backer. Representative Edelson.
Here.
Representative Fisher.
Fisher, present.
Representative Freiberg.
Present.
Representative Hewitt.
Here.
Representative Liebling. Representative Liebling. Representative Mann.
Present.
Representative New.
Present.
Representative Pearson.
Here.
Representative Pinto.
Present.
Representative Robbins.
Present.
Representative Schumacher. Representative Schumacher.
Present.
One moment. Jazzy, we lost you after Representative Schumacher.
Okay.
Jazzy, can you please call Representative Schultz on the roll call?
Representative Schultz?
Present.
Representative Bonner is present as well.
Yes.
Representative Bonner. Got it. Sorry about that.
Okay. And as others chime in, we would also recognize you at that time. I would recognize you at that time. So members, before we get to our main agenda, I need to approve the minutes from my last meeting, my last hearing, which was on Wednesday, March the 11th. The meetings were included in the hearing documents emailed to you by our committee staff, and we are authorized to approve them using a voice vote. Are there any questions on the minutes from anyone? Okay. I believe Representative Morrison have read the meetings. So Representative Morrison moves approval of the minutes for Wednesday, March the 11th. We will briefly unmute all members for a voice vote on that motion. All in favor say aye.
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 Okay.
One moment. I think that's coming from the House Info Office when I unmuted. One moment. Okay, sorry about that. Chair Brand, could you redo the voice vote?
So all in favor of the minutes from March the 11th, please say aye.
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 The motion prevails. The motion prevails and the minutes are approved for Wednesday, March the 11th. And so I just want to say, I want to ask for everyone patience as we go through this most challenging period of doing our work remotely. This is our first hearing that we have had remotely. And so as we do this, we are working through the kinks just so that we can get through this informational hearing. So I just appreciate your patience and everyone being in attendance today. House File 3134 is the vehicle bill for this committee, Human Service Policy Bill. The 820-0745, delete all amendments, should be treated as the base document for the bill. So this is our Health and Human Service Policy Omnibus Bill. So this is also the companion bill to the policy bill that Senator Abler moved out of his committee last week. My office has been working very closely with Senator Abler throughout this session to get to this point, but also to align as many of our priorities as possible. And most of the bills in today's amendment are also in his proposal. Once this bill moves to the General Register, it is our mutual hope that we can resolve any remaining differences in our bills before taking a floor vote and avoid the need to have a conference committee. So there are a few things I would like to say about this bill up front. First, I want to make sure that members and the public understand that this bill is only addressing human service policies only, which is Senator Abler's committee jurisdiction. It does not cover issues like public health, the scope of practice, insurance, or healthcare. Senator Benson and I are developing a plan to continue moving forward on legislation related to those bills that are in her preview, but they were not and are not a part of this bill. Second, I want to acknowledge that this is a long bill. It's not a long bill because there's a lot of new policies in here. As the articles get longer, they also become more technical. So Article 4 and 5 and 6 make up about 2/3 of the total bill, but they are almost entirely technical pieces within the bill. So these changes are long overdue within the department, and they will help make the current law more transparent to the public, as well as easier to amend for the legislature and for our nonpartisan staff to be able to follow the laws that we are creating here. So I have included them in this bill to ensure that we get them done this session. Speaking of nonpartisan staff, this is also a good time to say thank you to nonpartisan staff, to say thank you to the House Research, to the Revisor's Office for assembling this amendment under what we would call less than ideal circumstances. Okay, they have put a lot of hard work into this bill. So third, this amendment contains some bills that we have not heard in committee until now. So included in this bill are several DHS proposals that we had planned to hear on March the 13th before the meeting was canceled due to COVID-19. To ensure this language is vetted by members and the public, We are dedicating today's agenda to discuss the bill. And we have invited the chief authors to present their bill to the committee. We will wait until next week to take formal actions on any of the bill. So for purposes to say this again, it's just an informational hearing. And our reason to do this is that we hope that as you hear the bills today for the first time, that you would take back what you heard, vet it, connect with the authors or DHS staff to get more information. You know, if you need to move amendments, you can do so at that time, because we will bring in these, we'll be bringing these bills back next week, next Wednesday, for a vote on the bill. Let's see. I do want to thank the department for scaling back their policies request to focus on their top priorities and for working with the stakeholders over the last several weeks to achieve a type of consensus on these proposals that we will hear today. Finally, this bill is overwhelming bipartisan, with most of these proposals that are definitely been carried by DFLers, but almost every one of them has a Republican co-author in the House and a Republican chief author in the Senate for both. This bill is intended to do as much good as possible for people receiving services from the state of Minnesota without appropriating a single dollar of state funds. And I sincerely hope that we can move this bill out of committee with everyone's support next Wednesday. If you have questions or concerns about any of the language you hear today, I encourage you again to take the week to speak with stakeholders and to figure out how we can get, if at all possible, a yes from every member. So we're going to do a quick walkthrough today now. So with that, I'm going to ask House Research to do a walkthrough of the bill. We'll stop after each article to see if there are any clarifying questions about bills that we have previously heard. Mrs. Sunderman is going to take the lead on that. And I would like for her, I would like for you, Mrs. Sutherland, to please explain Article 1 for us, and while Mrs. Sunderman is explaining Article 1 of the bill, Chris will do a share screen for us to all see the bill that she is discussing. So I'm going to pass this over now to Mrs. Sutherland.
All right, Madam Chair and members, as you said, I'll be walking through Article 1. So Section 1 of Article 1 was from House File 1883, the first engrossment, which I believe was heard in education policy. This proposes a new section that would require a student in foster care to be enrolled in school within 7 days of being placed in a foster home, and also allows a student who's already enrolled in the district to remain in that same district, even if the foster home is in a different district. Section 2 amends the Cultural and Ethnic Communities Leadership Council. We, I believe, heard this in our committee, and it went through a couple other committees. So I'll just quickly highlight, I guess, the main difference. So generally, this section makes a lot of mainly clarifying and structural changes to the Cultural and Ethnic Communities Leadership Council. The main change with the latest engrossment that this committee wouldn't have been familiar with was the change to the this latest engrossment and the section that's in the bill removes the expiration date entirely. Before, there was some language about that the council expires when ethnic and racial disparities no longer exist. But the latest committee amended that, and that similar language is found on lines 1.16 and 1.17. So it's there, but no longer in the expiration section. The next section, section 3, was from House File 3632. This is relating to the Family Assets for Independence Program, which provides incentives for low-income individuals to accrue assets. And this section, first, it adds vehicles to the list of assets for which incentives may be provided under the program. And the most of the rest of the sections relate to that. So the subdivision 2 modifies the definition of permissible use to add acquiring a vehicle. Subdivision 3 removes a requirement that fiduciary organizations document the capacity to raise a private match. Subdivision 4A requires financial coaches to provide asset-specific training related to buying a vehicle for the program participants. and then Section 6 relates to the non-state matching contribution. So it removes that language and increases the lifetime limit on state grant or TANF fund contributions from 3,000 to 6,000, but it doesn't change the total lifetime limit, just changes where that money comes from. And then Subdivision 7 adds the number of vehicles paid for with money from the program into the fiscal agent quarterly reporting requirements. Section 4 is also from House File 1883, the first engrossment related to the school foster care, and just requires the Commissioner of Human Services to report on school enrollments within 7 days of being of a student being placed in a foster home. Section 5, this contains the language from two bills that amended the same section. The first being House File 3104, the base for this DE. And this was also, there was a DE amendment to House File 3276 that had this language too. So that added Subdivision 6 to this section, which is requiring the Responsible Social Services Agency to coordinate an initial phone call between foster care providers and parents of children in foster care. And it further details what needs to be involved in that call, when the call needs to be happened, how it's documented, et cetera. Subdivision 7 was from House File 3159, the first engrossment, requires the Responsible Social Services Agency to coordinate a prenatal alcohol exposure screening for any child entering foster care. And then it lays out the timeline and the qualifications and how the screenings need to be conducted. And finally, Section 6 is related to the initial foster care phone call requirement and just requires the Commissioner of Human Services to issue written guidance by August 1st, 2020 in order to implement the initial foster care phone call requirements. And that section is effective upon final enactment. That concludes Article 1. Happy to take questions or hand it over to Ms. Pinelli.
Okay, is there any questions from any of the members? And again, all the bills within Article 1 were bills that were heard in committee. Okay, seeing no questions, why don't we move on to Article 2 with the focus on community support with Ms. Pinelli. And we do have DHS also available for any DHS questions. Ms. Pinelli?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. I'm going to go through Article 2, which is the Community Supports Administration article. So for anybody who's following along in the delete all amendment, Article 2 starts at the top of page 14. And the first section comes from House File 3206, which I don't think the committee had a chance to hear before we started working from home. This is from Representative Acomb's ARM policy bill, and it is modifying the corporate foster care moratorium by extending one of the exceptions to the moratorium related to allowing foster care homes to have a fifth bed under certain circumstances. Section 2 is from House File 3336. This is the sexual violence prevention training bill. And Section 2 is just adding a definition of sexual violence to the chapter of statutes related to home and community-based services, settings, and standards. Section 3 is from House File 3206 again, and this is modifying the long-term care home and community-based services and supports assessment and initial service planning provision. It's modifying the timeline and the people that are included in the service planning. And the language has been changed from what was originally in the bill. If you look at the delete all amendment on lines 16.29 and 16.30, you can see the new language. I believe in the underlying bill, originally it was allowing for this initial service planning to happen within 45 days of service, and then the underlying bill was adding or within 90 calendar days, and now that's been changed to 60 calendar days of initial service initiation. The other change that is in this section actually comes from House File 4204, which is one of the DHS policy bills, and that language is on page 17. And it's adding several items to the list of items that need to be addressed in the initial service plan. And it's adding items such as opportunities to develop and maintain essential and life-enriching skills and opportunities to seek competitive employment. Moving on to Section 4, that also comes from House File 3206. This is also amending a section of statutes that's in the Home and Community-Based Services Standards chapter. It's related to coordination and evaluation of individual service delivery. And it's allowing for the designated coordinator to delegate certain duties to another individual that's already been previously deemed competent in certain activities. Sections 5, 6, and 7 all come from House File 3336, which is the Sexual Violence Prevention Training Bill. Section 5 is adding a requirement that sexual violence prevention training be included in orientation training for direct support staff. And then sections 6 and 7 are just making a conforming change related to the addition of that requirement. Section 8 comes from House File 3801. And this is clarifying the MA excess income standard for persons who are elderly, blind, or have disabilities. Section 9 is from House File 3359. That is the Consumer-Directed Community Supports Codification Bill. And this section is modifying the definition of covered program by making some technical changes. It adds a cross-reference and it corrects some terminology. Section 10 comes from House File 3866, which I also don't think the committee had a chance to hear. This really is more of a technical fix. It's reinstating some language that requires the commissioner to provide at least a 90-day notice to lead agencies before the effective date of requiring the Min Choices assessment for PCA assessments. This is language that had been in statute prior to last year, and then in the omnibus bill last year, this language was inadvertently stricken as part of a larger package of changes that was made to the Min Choices assessment language, and so this is just being reinstated here. Sections 11 and 12 come from House File 3445, which is related to psychiatric residential treatment facilities. Section 11 is removing the requirement to involve the state medical review agent in determining and documenting the need for psychiatric residential treatment facility services. And it's adding some language requiring department oversight and utilization reviews of psychiatric residential treatment facility referrals and admissions, and to coordinate a statewide list of children who meet the psychiatric residential treatment facility medical necessity criteria and are awaiting admission. And then section 12 is modifying the psychiatric residential treatment facility per diem rate to be per provider rather than a statewide average rate. And the remainder of this article, sections 13 through 18, all come from House File 3359, which again is the consumer-directed community supports codification and some corrections to terminology. Section 13 makes some technical changes, removes some obsolete language, and corrects terminology related to consumer-directed community supports. Section 14 looks like it's all new language, but really this language is just being moved from session laws into statute. And it's all language that's related to the consumer-directed community support. So it's got language that deals with costs associated with physical activities, some budget exceptions, and allowing for shared services. Sections 15 and 16 are just making some corrections to terminology related to CDCS. Section 17 is basically just stating that any federal approval that the commissioner has asked for related to CDCS services is still in effect and transfers over to the language that we're moving into statute and doesn't go away, since in the next section, section 18, we're repealing all of the session laws related to CDCS. And that is all of Article 2. I'm happy to answer any questions. Otherwise, I can hand it back to Ms. Sunderman to talk about Articles 4, 5, and 6.
Okay, members, are there any other questions? I would like to acknowledge that Representative Keel and Leiden has joined the committee hearing. For Article 3 members, all of Article 3 is DHS language, and we will be discussing that language today. And so we're going to move on to Article 4 with Ms. Sutherman. And we also have
Madam Chair, can I just ask one question on this, what you just covered?
Yes. Yes, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Section 11 and 12, Ms. Sunderman, can you just clarify? I've heard some interesting things. It sounds like for psychiatric residential treatment facilities, those are considered residential treatment, correct?
Ms. Pinelli?
Sections 11 and 12 of this.
Of Article 2, correct?
Yep, the eligibility for the psychiatric residential treatments. What my understanding is private plans are not covering them. And I'm wondering if in the language and interpretation that you're hearing or you're reading, is there any reason that they should not be covering them?
And maybe Matt Burdick can answer that question, or Christy Gami.
Hi, Madam Chair. Matt Burdick from DHS here. Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
And I unfortunately would have to defer private health insurance questions to the Department of Commerce and Department of Health, who oversee those plans. What I can say is PRTF is considered a hospital level of care. It's technically an inpatient benefit.
Madam Chair, I guess I'm curious from the language, though. It should technically be covered under the language, though, correct?
And Madam Chair, I'm happy to follow up with my colleagues at the other departments who could speak to the requirements for commercial health insurers.
That'd be great. That would be great. Thank you.
And thank you. And I want to apologize. They're not one just here, remote hearing piece today. So with that, we're going to move on to Article 4. And Ms. Sutherman, can you please explain Article 4 for us?
Sure, Madam Chair members, if we skip, I believe it's to page 123 of the bill, or the DE, and page 22 of the summary. I believe everyone should have seen this before. This is from House File 2898, the third engrossment. So instead of going through section by section, I'll just do a quick overview and then highlight a few of the things that may be different than the last time you saw this. So this article is basically a very large update to Chapter 253B and then also some provisions of Chapter 253D, governing civil commitment. A lot of the changes are technical, updating terminology and references, that sort of thing. A lot of the article is clarifying existing provisions and updating the chapter to generally more accurately reflect how the process works and how treatment works in the civil commitment context. One notable thing it does, it adds engagement services to the range of services related to civil commitment. To highlight a couple of things that might be different, go to page 125, there were a couple of changes in the health officer definition from the last time this committee saw it. Some previously stricken language was reinstated to allow social workers to continue to qualify as health officers. And to also include a formally designated member of a pre-petition screening unit. That was also reinstating some language on page 125. Let's see. Throughout the article, neuroleptic is reinstated after, I believe, some stakeholder concerns about the previously suggested change to psychotropic medications. So basically, what was the change to psychotropic is now changed back to neuroleptic, so there is no change to current statute, just a change from the previous versions of this bill. There is a change, there was language added on page 132 to allow a provider to subject a person to treatment contrary to their written declaration of preferences in emergency situations. on page 138, it makes the DHS Engagement Services Evaluation Pilot Project optional, just changing a shall to a must or shall to a may. And then finally, there was language, to go back to section 2, to allow for certain APRNs to qualify as examiners if they're practicing in an emergency room at a critical access hospital. And that would be back on page 124. Sorry to go out of order. So those are the, and there were a couple other very minor clarifying language changes in the successive versions, but that would conclude Article 4, if there are any questions.
Okay. Any questions, members? All right, seeing none, we're going to move on to Article 5 and Article 6, which is the Maltreatment of Minors Act reorganizations. And Mrs. Sullivan is going to also explain those two articles for us.
All right, Madam Chair and members, everyone has also seen the vast majority of Article 5, which is the Maltreatment of Minors Act reorganization and recodification. This reorganizes and recodifies what is currently Section 626.556, which governs the reporting of maltreatment of minors, and it puts it into a new chapter of statute, which is 260E. And so it breaks it up into sections and subdivisions, which is a good change from the current organization. It also includes some provisions from sections adjacent to 626.556 that relate to maltreatment of minors. the vast majority of the changes are very, very technical. It does add some definitions, which is a good change for egregious harm, maltreatment, a person in a current or recent position of authority, and significant relationship. One thing that is different in this DE from the first engrossment of House File 1732 is that this DE incorporates the change from House File 1892, which Representative Morrison's bill. And that is on line 234.20 to 234.23. And this is removing the reporting requirement for treating physicians for prenatal substance use. And I believe that's about it for the Maltreatment of Minors Act reorganization. If anyone has any questions, I can just say Article 6 is the conforming changes article related to the Maltreatment of Minors Act reorganization. So it just changes references throughout statute. That concludes Articles 5 and 6.
Any questions, members? Okay, seeing no questions. Members, we want to go back to Article 2 now and begin the author's presentations for new language within this bill. We ask bill authors to keep their initial remarks brief so that we have time for questions. And we're going to try to move quickly through the shorter bills first. So please remember that we are not voting on any language today. So if we get behind schedule a little bit, I will ask members to take their questions offline because we're going to have a week between now and next Wednesday when we will be taking a vote on this bill. Representative Schultz, will we start with you? Can you please explain for us House File 3866?
Thank you, Chair Moran. And House File 3866 restores language. A 90-day notice requires a 90-day notice to lead agencies when Minnesota Choice's assessments are required for personal care assistance services. So it adds one sentence to existing language.
All right. Thank you. Okay. Any questions on that? Very minor change that took a lot of work to get it to this part. All right.
Madam Chair, we're just having a little disconnect here on communication. I believe Representative Keel had a question before we got to the Schultz language.
Okay, Representative Keel on House File 3866.
Great. Representative Keel. Yes, I just was going to ask if she would reference Page, thinking it was in the DE amendment. That was all. Whoever is referring to bills. No, not a big deal. Just we're talking about the individual bills now, correct? Not the DE.
Yes, Representative Peel, we are on the individual bills. Did you have another previous question before that?
No, no.
Okay. Representative Schultz, do you have anything to add to that?
So this is bipartisan support. It's being carried by Senator Abler in the Senate.
All right. Okay. Thank you. So we're going to move on to House File 3336, which is Representative Moeller's bill, which provides direct support staff for licensing homes and community-based services training requirements that have been modified. Representative Moeller, which is, are you available?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm here. Thank you.
Please.
So thank you for the opportunity to present House File 3336 today. Sexual violence is a public health crisis in Minnesota, and unfortunately, people with disabilities experience this at a rate of 7 times higher than those without. Direct support professionals, or DSPs, work directly with people with disabilities to support them in achieving their community and self-directed goals, and they're key partners in the sexual violence prevention efforts. This bill would require competency-based training for DSPs on sexual violence prevention. In orientation and subsequent annual trainings, they will be equipped with the tools they need to engage the individuals they support in meaningful ways to create a culture of sexual violence prevention and support healthy, positive relationships. This proposal is supported by over a dozen providers and advocacy groups, and I do have a testifier here today, Madam Chair.
Yes, well, thank you. I believe you have testified, Julie Gundry. Can you please introduce your name and pronounce your name for us? Thank you.
Julie Gundry is my name.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. And
go ahead.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Julie Gundry, and I've been working with and alongside the disability community for more than 20 years. Most recently leading the organization that I co-founded in 2006, Upstream Arts. I'm also a parent of a child, of a 28-year-old child who lives with significant cognitive and developmental delays and who does not use words to communicate. He accesses 24/7 support from a web of nurses and direct support professionals, or DSPs. And I want you to know that he has every capacity to share with us his preferences and choices. He can smile and he can laugh. He can be sad and he can mourn. And he can feel and he can experience this wonderful, terrible, beautiful world that we all live in. When he was 16, he was sexually assaulted by a peer at a camp. When support staff encountered the situation, they didn't have the tools or the knowledge to respond, and it was clear that no one had been trained on how they could have helped prevent this incident. We'll always remember the lack of response and preventative action taken. These things can happen, was the sentiment that was shared with us on that day. And although I know that these things do happen, I do not believe that they are inevitable. Upstream Arts has an in-depth partnership with more than 30 adult day programs around the metro in which we offer sexual violence prevention trainings for individuals with disabilities and their staff. One such provider is Midwest Special Services, which also offers day services for my son. Through both my personal and my professional experience, I can tell you that DSPs are pivotal partners in prevention. They can see signs or symptoms of abuse. They can be a resource for people with disabilities who need information on what a healthy relationship is, and they can model appropriate boundaries. Moreover, DSPs want and need information and training specific to prevention of sexual violence. They believe in the importance and power of this information, and they are struggling to find the appropriate resources and tools they need to succeed. I'm here today to urge you to support House File 3336, which calls for DSPs to be trained on specific strategies to prevent sexual violence. The training proposed will have a significant impact, not just for my kid, but for any individual with a disability who receives direct services from 245D licensed providers in our community. HF 3336 is the result of a growing momentum of organizations on the part of disability advocacy organizations, service providers, and trade associations, all working together to ensure that sexual violence, which is so profoundly prevalent within the disability community, is not inevitable. It's been a long practice to provide services for people with disabilities guided by a lens of protection rather than prevention. And the results demonstrate that the failure of that protection system, people with disabilities are 7 times more likely to be sexually assaulted in their lifetime. My experience with Upstream Arts and as a parent has compelled me to be a part of a prevention work and to be here speaking with all of you today. And we ask members of this committee to see the value of educating our direct support professionals about sexual violence prevention, a much needed and necessary step towards undermining the epidemic of sexual violence being perpetrated against our disability community. And we must educate our entire community, including people with disabilities and those that are in the closest relationships with them, direct support professionals. The disability community deserves this attention and support and truly believes in the vision that you have to effect this change. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much for your testimony. Sorry to hear what happened to your son, but we really do appreciate your story, sharing your story today. Thank you. Is there any questions? Okay, seeing no other questions, we're gonna move on. And again, thank you to the testifier. We're gonna move on to House File 3206 ACOM, which is the art policy bill. Representative Acom.
Good afternoon. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. I'm here to discuss House File 3206, which is part of the community support section and is the ARM policy bill. There are three provisions that we're looking at changing today. And so this bill has three common sense adjustments that allow providers to use the resources in a more efficient way while meeting the needs of the individuals they are supporting. The first section, extends a sunset date that would allow providers to have a fifth person move into a residential site. The second section modifies the timeline for providers to have an initial service review and planning meeting with an individual, accounting for the different ways that services are provided today. And the third section streamlines the training process for items that are specific to individuals, allowing for the most appropriate person to be providing the training and determining staff competency of those items. We do have bipartisan support, and in the Senate, the bill is authored by Senator Yuki. And with that introduction, I will turn it over to my testifier, Sarah Grafstrom, to go into more detail on the bill.
Yes, to Sarah Grafstrom, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Sarah Grafstrom. I am the Director of State and Federal Policy at ARM. As Representative Acom shared, ARM's policy initiatives this session are aimed at making sensible reforms, allowing providers to better utilize the resources they have while still meeting the needs of the individuals they're supporting. At this point, I'll provide an overview of the three components that Representative Acom referenced, and then stand for any questions folks have. So beginning on line 15.28 through 15.31 of the Delete Everything Amendment, we are proposing an extension to the sunset date for which providers are able to add a fifth bed to a community residential setting. This variance was previously in place but expired on June 30th of 2019, and our language would allow this option until June 30th of 2024. I think it's important when considering this language, remember that a provider can only operate a five-bed home if everyone in the home agrees to it, and overall statewide capacity is not increased. The language also changes the date for which a provider must be licensed to apply for a fifth bed, while still ensuring the variance is only available to established providers. Moving on to line 16.29 through 16.33, we are proposing an adjustment to the timeline for when an individual needs to have what is commonly called a 45-day meeting. Current law says for all services that are considered sub, within 45 days of the first day of service, an individual has to have another meeting with their service provider and support team discuss how the services are going and any changes they want to make going forward, as well as discuss desired outcomes and goals of services. This works really well for residential settings like a group home, where the provider is seeing the individual every day and gets to know the individual. The problem we're trying to address is for unit-based services, when the provider may at times only provide services to an individual for a few times a week for a couple hours at a time. Having to turn around and have a meeting 45 days after the initial service date can feel rushed to both the individual and the provider. Our bill states that the meeting has to happen within 45 days of service or 60 calendar days, whichever is shorter. This way, services that are provided daily will still meet the 45-day threshold, but services that are provided more sporadically will have a slightly longer window to provide services and get to know the individual. And finally, line 18.9 through 18.12 will allow the designated coordinator to designate that a qualified individual can determine competency of a staff person for items included in an individual's community service support plan addendum, or items that are specific to the individual and their support needs. I think the best way to explain this change is through an example. So if an individual that is receiving services requires culturally specific meals, a provider might bring in the individual's mom to train the staff on how to prepare those meals. Current statute would then require the designated coordinator to come in and determine if the staff is competent in preparing those meals, even though they may now have no idea how to do it themselves. This bill would allow the designated coordinator to say that mom, in this example, is competent in training the staff and can then determine competency of the staff after the training is complete. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much, Rastrom, for your testimony. Do we have any questions? Any questions on House
Bill? Madam Chair.
Representative Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I do have some questions about some of this. I want to preface this by saying this: it's at moments like this that I really miss Diane Loeffler, because she knew a lot about these issues, which I feel like I really still do not. But one issue that I know has come up many times over the years is this issue about having five people in a group home as opposed to four. And I know Ms. Grafstrom just talked about removing that sunset. The bill pushes the sunset out 5 years. And clearly that's a benefit to providers. Some providers, we know there are staff shortages and things like that. But I'd like to hear a little more discussion of the other side of that as well. I mean, there's some reason why we've gone back and forth on this in the state. I think that Diane Loeffler would have been somebody who pushed back against the idea of having a fifth person. I might be wrong about that, but I'd like to understand that a little bit more. Ms. Pugnelli can discuss it a little bit more of the history of that, because you know, clearly there are going to be advantages for the providers. I understand that there has to be agreement of the people living in the home and so on. But we're moving toward more people in a setting. It becomes less home-like the more people you get in there. I'd just like to hear a bit more discussion about this, if that could happen.
Ms. Grafstrom, do you think you can respond and give us some different some reasons why we are moving from four to five? Please.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Liebling. So I think initially I would just like to respond with a little bit of data that I pulled from our recent industry survey from our members. So we surveyed 140 of our providers, 71 had responded, so a response rate of about 50%. And among those 71 that responded, 14 of our providers reported that they actually operated a home with five people. And out of those 14, there are 51 programs statewide. So I would say this is certainly not something that we see widespread across the state. The setting has to be correct to make this work. The individuals have to be willing, and it has to be the right fit for everyone involved. I think any provider or individual will tell you that forcing a situation benefits no one. So there's no provider out there that's really going to try enforce a five-bed home if it's not the right fit for the individuals that are being supported. I will just give one example of where we're running into this year. Representative Haley actually has a constituent. She has two sisters that are currently being supported in Rochester right now that want to move closer to their aging father. They've always lived together. They want to move, I think it's Wadena or a different city in southern Minnesota. But with, you know, the outstate settings and staffing resources as it is, the best setting right now for those two to live together is a home that the provider operates that could operate as a five-person home. So one sister has moved into the home and the other sister is waiting for the ability now to move into that home. So it's very specific situations that we see providers wanting to use this fifth bed variance, but when it happens, it's very helpful to those that are in that situation.
Well, Madam Chair, I mean, I guess that's a little bit helpful, but it really doesn't kind of answer my main question, which is why did we have a sunset on this in the first place? Usually when we do that, it's because we want to get some kind of data. We're trying to figure something out. I'm not really understanding why it's another 5 years. I mean, the situation that was described, I don't know if there's an opportunity for waivers in a situation like that. But I'm just not entirely comforted that this is in the best interest of the people being supported, not just in the interest of the people providing the service. So I assume that when you put five people in a group home instead of four, that you're getting just the rates are the same. So there is obviously a financial benefit to the provider. But
I'm still not
understanding the history of it.
Representative Bacon.
Yeah, I just wanted to speak to the concerns. And I think that, you know, waivers are a method to provide flexibility, as are the extension that's being asked for today. And I think that, as has been indicated, everybody has to be in agreement. And if they're not, then it can't go forward. And we've also been shown that by the numbers that Ms. Grafstrom presented, it's not a very large sector of the homes that are using this opportunity or this option. And so while I appreciate the concerns, and I think we should always be looking at things, you know, to ensure that the best care for the residents and the people receiving these services is received. And I think this is just a tool that is to hopefully allow some flexibility.
And Madam Chair?
Okay, I'm gonna let you respond, then we're gonna move on with this, because I hear, and what I did hear is that this is a special circumstances where we have two sisters who've always lived together who now, for whatever reason, cannot. And so we wanna create a space where she can, but really quick.
Madam Chair, I was just gonna respond to Representative Liebling's initial questions about why the sunset. My understanding historically that as to why we've always had a sunset is just, for us to be able to continue having conversations with the advocacy community as to whether or not this is still appropriate and is still in the best interest of the disability community. So we keep that sunset date. So every 2 or 4 years, whatever it is, we're getting together again and saying, are we all okay with moving forward with this again? Is it still needed within our disability community to look at our current situation? And is everyone on board with moving forward with that?
All right. Right, thank you so much. We're gonna move on to, and again, we're not taking a vote on this, so Chair Liebling, if you need more, please check in with Representative Akam or Mrs. Grafstrom. We're gonna move on to House File 3972, which is a DHS Operation Policy Bill. And I'm going to hand this over to Chris Zimpel, who is the Legislative Director of Operation at DHS, to kind of like run through this operation, DHS operation bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is Chris Zimpel, Legislative Director for Operations at DHS. We have two sections in the operations bill. Sorry, my screen closed there. The first is section 11 in Article 3. And that section is language that the FBI has requested we change, removing the words county and private agencies and inserting just counties. They've asked us to remove this for sharing information about our background studies subjects to just counties in 245C. And so this will bring us into compliance with the FBI to retain access to FBI fingerprint databases. The second section, section 35, was introduced, is a fix from a bill from last session. Last session, we expanded the authority of DHS, Office of Inspector General, to fine Medicaid programs for repeated program violations. And there was one section of law that was left out in that bill, allowing us to fine substance use disorder programs who receive Medicaid funds. So this would add that section of law. And Madam Chair, that is the operations part.
All right. Do we have any questions? All right. Pretty simple. So we're going to move on. We're going to move on to House File 3880, which is Representative Pryor's bill, which is a DHS child support policy bill. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Yes, House File 3880 is a child support policy changes, and I will give the overview of the bill, and I have a testifier ready if you have any specific questions about the different sections. So this bill makes important changes to improve efficiency and federal compliance on a number of child support statutes. The bill will allow the child support program to better protect parents by keeping their addresses confidential when a parent has a concern for their safety and the cases requires court action. Further, the bill brings the state into compliance with the Consumer Credit Protection Act in regards to withholding of lump sums for child support collection. The bill makes the process of reinstating hunting and fishing licenses easier for payers of child support after a license has been suspended because of non-payment of support. The bill deletes a paragraph of the reporting statute because the child support program is unable to report child support debt as the statute requires. And finally, the bill helps tribal families by allowing their court case to be transferred to the tribe. This will allow their court case and their child support case to be handled together in their tribal systems.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. We have a testifier, Jennifer Summerfield, who's also the Director of Legislation and Internal Affairs at DHS. Ms. Summerfield, do you have anything to add to House File 3880?
Good afternoon, Representative Moran, members of the committee. I don't have anything to add, but I am certainly available to answer questions.
All right. Well, thank you. Do we have any questions? All right. There being no questions, we're going to move on to House File 4277, which is Representative Jordan, which is a MSOCS termination of services modification bill. Representative Jordan.
Hi there, Madam Chair. And sorry, I'm trying to pull up my notes here. Okay. Madam Chair, members, thank you for your consideration of this provision. As amended, this provision represents the collaboration of stakeholders, direct care, and treatment at DHS to create a needed mechanism for state-operated services to transition individuals from state-operated facilities to private providers. Additionally, Section 21 adds language to promote safety in state-operated facilities. Since 2017, DCT has been legislatively directed to prioritize beds in its group homes in state-operated community-based programs for individuals with complex behavioral needs that cannot be supported by private community-based providers. DCT has been working to align its service model by transitioning programs not currently supporting these individuals to private providers and focusing DCT's operations to existing and new programs for these individuals with complex needs. These changes relate only to state-operated services, and they will help create needed capacity for individuals with these complex behavioral needs in our state-operated system. Additionally, these changes create opportunities for individuals no longer needing this elevated level of support to move to more integrated community settings. This language has been worked on and vetted by a number of community stakeholders and employees working in direct care, and I'm very grateful for their input and work. I'd like to introduce Laura Lane, who is the legislative director for direct care and treatment. She would be happy to provide additional information regarding this bill or address any questions that any members may have.
Thank you, Representative Jordan. I have a couple of questions, and I mean, and you might have said this, I just maybe drifted off or something. But what does MSOCS stand for, and what do DCT stand for?
Madam Chair, Laura Lane, Legislative Director for Direct Care and Treatment, DCT. And MSOCS is the Minnesota State Operated Community Services.
Thank you.
So it is our community-based program of group homes throughout the state.
I appreciate that. Ms. Lane, do you have anything to add to the testimony of this bill?
No, Madam Chair, but I am happy to stand for any questions that you or any members might have.
All right, thank you so much. Are there any questions? All right, well, thank you, Representative Jordan. We're going to move on to House File 4204, which is Representative Jordan's bill also. It deals with DHS Community Supports and Administration Policy Bill. Would you like to give us some information?
I'll give you a quick overview, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Yes. Manager members, these sections are from the DHS Community Supports Policy Bill. These provisions make changes related to behavioral health, disability services, and housing. Some of the changes are technical or clarifying in nature. Others have more substantive policy impacts. All the changes have been reviewed by community stakeholders, and DHS has been really careful to ensure concerns and suggestions have been addressed in this language. I also have with me Matt Burdick and Christy Crum, both from DHS. Matt and Christy, would like to provide an overview of each section and answer any questions we might have. And with that, I'd like to just turn it over to Matt and Christy.
Okay. Was it Crummy?
And Madam Chair, this is Matt Burdick. I might kick things off and we'll go back and forth quickly here to walk through so members have a sense of what's in these provisions.
Yes.
And the section numbers I'm going to be referencing are tied to the DE amendment in Article 3, just in case folks are following along with the bill language. So the first piece that relates to community supports is Section 3. This relates to children's mental health respite care grants. This makes two changes. One is expanding the universe of children who are eligible for these grants. The current statute limits it to children who meet a threshold of what's called severe emotional disturbance. And this would change that threshold to emotional disturbance, which is a lower bar, but still represents high needs for children. It also clarifies that a child is not required to be actively receiving case management in order to access the services funded by these grants. This doesn't change the amount of grant funding available, just expands the universe of children who can access them. And I'll turn it over to Christy for the next item.
Okay, please proceed. Introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair and members, for the record, my name is Christy Grum. I'm with the Department of Human Services. So Section 20, as well as the provisions in Article 2, Section 3 that Ms. Quinelli mentioned earlier, are clarifications related to person-centered support planning and the federal home and community-based services rule. So the federal rule requires that settings funded by HCBS waivers reflect the nature of what would be considered an integrated community setting rather than an institutional one. Providers are already compliant with this rule, and this change just clarifies that they document that compliance in a person support plan addendum, essentially ensuring our ongoing commitment to person-centered support planning and compliance with the federal rule.
All right.
Madam Chair, I'll cover the next several. sections 23 through 27, as well as section 94, which is a repealer. This is cleanup related to the implementation of a new service that helps people with substance use disorders who are in acute withdrawal. It's known as withdrawal management. The big change here is the current statute requires that these programs have a medical director on site 7 days a week. And we've realized that that is not actually a practical requirement that folks can meet. And so this is changing that requirement so that they are available, but not necessarily having to be on site. And this aligns with the American Society of Addiction Medicine standards, which is what we modeled this service off. Sections 28 and 30 are cleanup related to a proposal that was passed last session related to screening, brief intervention, and referral to treatment. This is a short questionnaire that oftentimes primary care providers can use to identify if someone might have substance use issues. The change we made last year allows this tool to authorize a limited subset of substance use disorder services so that a person can get into treatment before they go and get a full assessment of their needs. This makes some codifying and clarifying changes to make sure that we can implement that. Things like we don't have to do a full assessment before these services are provided, which was the entire intent of the legislature last year. And so this was a lot of cleanup from last year related to that provision in order to operationalize what the changes that the legislature made were. Section 31 is updating a cross-reference related to licensed professionals in private practice who deliver substance use disorder care. Again, it's a cross-reference update. This was something the legislature changed in 2017 to allow for independent practitioners to deliver services outside of a licensed treatment setting. So similar to other independent practitioners in other parts of our healthcare system. And this makes a conforming change to allow for that to happen. And I'll turn it back to Ms. Grum.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Section 36 is a provision that addresses an issue related to family foster care and the ability for children in those settings to access PCA and home care nursing. So current law prohibits personal care assistance in home care nursing and family foster care settings that are licensed for a capacity of greater than four. And this change would allow larger sibling groups to be placed in a family foster care setting or to remain in a family foster care setting while still being able to maintain their PCA and home care nursing services. We think this is an important change because we know that outcomes are better for kids when they can remain together with their sibling group. And we've also heard from providers and lead agencies that the current restriction in law is inhibiting that from happening in some cases. And the next sections are also me. So sections 37 through 44 deal with the early intensive developmental behavioral intervention benefit, also known as EIDBI. This is a Medicaid benefit for children 21 years of age and younger who have autism spectrum disorder or a related condition. And these provisions mostly make clarifying and technical changes to conform with the DSM and current clinical practice, but there are two more substantive changes that I'll touch on briefly. The first being related to the prohibition of punishment-based treatment methods. So since EIDBI is not a licensed DHS service, it's not subject to the positive support rule, which, among other things, prohibits the use of punishment-based treatment methods. Research shows that aversive and punishment-based practices aren't effective for long-term treatment. So this change adds a statutory prohibition to those methods for the purposes of EIDBI. And then the next substantive change in this area is related to staff training. So current law doesn't specify a timeline for the completion of EIDBI staff training. So this just specifies that staff training must be complete within 6 months of the date of hire. We have worked with stakeholders on all of this language, and I'm happy to stand for questions if members have specific items they wanted to address.
All right, thank you. Members, do you have any questions? Well, I want to thank Ms. Blum and Mr. Burdick for your participation and walking us through this bill. We're going to move on to our final bill, which is House File 3812. That's Representative Knorr on DHS Child Protection Policy Bill. Representative Knorr.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and members. This is House File 3812, Child Safety and Permanency Policy Bill. This bill enables tribes and counties to enter into written agreement that will allow for a transfer of the responsibility for the screening and initial response for a child maltreatment report regarding an Indian child who is a resident of a county where the Indian Child's Reservation is located from the county to the tribe. This bill authorizes unaccompanied minors experiencing homelessness to consent to homeless youth services and or services for sexually exploited youth. Currently, homeless youth providers and providers of services for sexually exploited youth do not have legal authority to provide services to minors without parental consent. Parents and guardians retain legal custody over their minor children. This does not infringe upon that legal custody. Child Protective Services, through court order, can also exercise legal and physical custody over minors. This bill contains provisions that will bring the state into compliance with the Federal Family First Prevention Services Act before it's effective nationwide on October 21, 2021. There have been significant changes to the bill's provisions related to QRTPs, which we will discuss shortly. I would like to ask Assistant Commissioner Lisa Bailey, who can walk us through some of the points in this bill. Madam Chair, also, we have had significant discussion with stakeholders. We've made some changes to the original bill. We do have a delete all bill that will cover those changes. So thank you so much, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you, Representative Knorr. Ms. Bailey, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for allowing us to come today and talk to you about these three important sections of this bill. The first one I'd like to address is about the tribal county maltreatment investigation responsibility. Essentially, under current law, it's unclear whether a county or a tribe is to investigate a maltreatment report of an Indian child living on a reservation that overlaps with the county. And without this legislative change, the county child protection agencies lack that clear authority to defer a child maltreatment response to any tribe that's not already authorized to deliver child welfare services to American Indian children. That would be as an initiative tribe. What this does is this allows the counties and tribes to enter into a written agreement regarding the responsibility of each for the screening and response to those child maltreatment reports of Indian children, respecting the sovereignty of tribes and recognizing that there are tribal governments with increased capacity to provide child protective services to children and families who are living on the reservation. And we believe that this improves the county-tribal relations with a common understanding concerning who has responsibility when those cases come up. The next section, Madam Chair, is about minor consent. And as Representative Knorr mentioned, currently unaccompanied minors who are experiencing homelessness, who need access to homeless youth services or services for sexually exploited youth, at the moment are unable to give authority to receive those services. In other words, if a minor appears at the door of a shelter asking for assistance, they still need to receive authority from a parent or a custodian to receive those services. This would allow the child, him or herself, to give consent for that, to receive those services. In other words, to be actually admitted to come into the facility and receive services. It does not, however, relieve the responsibility of the homeless youth provider or any provider of services to report those cases as they are already required to do under mandatory reporting law. So all of that would still be the same. It would still, as Representative Knorr mentioned, still give custody for or custodial rights for the parents would remain the same. And it would give the responsibility for addressing those cases will still be with the county. It addresses these unusual case where if a child were to present late on a Friday night and there was no county person available to give authority, the homeless youth provider cannot actually give services to that child. The last section is larger, and I'll just go over it very high level and then stand for questions, and I have here people here available from my office. And I should have mentioned I'm the Deputy Assistant Commissioner from the Children and Family Services. This is about the Federal Family First Prevention Services Act, which went into effect in 2018, which requires some fairly significant changes to Minnesota law. And a large portion of it that we're addressing here is regarding Title IV-E federal participation for foster care maintenance payments for a child who's placed in a group residential setting. Starting in the fall of 2021, October 2nd, 2021, payments for those settings, which are now allowed for longer than 2 weeks, will be limited to 2 weeks unless they meet certain very stringent exceptions. And the one that's relevant here is something called a Qualified Residential Treatment Program, or a QRTP. In order to meet the fairly stringent requirements, the first thing that we need to do in Minnesota is to amend our statute, and that's what this does. It would require Minnesota to update our 4E plan to show that those federal requirements have been put in place, and it's a fairly lengthy and complicated list of what we need to do. The reason we're asking for that now in 2020 is that it will take at least a year for us to implement and go through all of the different things that need to be changed in order for counties and tribes to be able to draw down those 4E payments starting in the fall of 2021. And that's the reason why we're coming to you now. Delays in this proposal will impact that federal approval of our Title IV-E plan and implementation of the Family First Act, which would put our federal funding at risk, at significant risk. And just for context, last year, we approximately between $5 and $7 million goes through DHS through to the tribes and counties to pay for those children residential facilities in those similar settings. Last month, before the pandemic, we had appeared at the Judiciary Committee. We heard significant concerns from NAMI, Sue Abderholden, who I believe is present today, and from Aspire Minnesota at that hearing. We had been already talking before then. We continued to talk after that. We worked to create a DE amendment to this bill, which we believe their primary concern relates to inclusion of the Chapter 260D voluntary foster placements in this piece and this change with the QRTP requirements. We worked to develop the compromise language which would exempt 260D placements from the QRTP requirements. And what it does is it gives us a year to work together, DHS to work with counties, tribes, specific stakeholders, and make recommendations to the legislature in January of 2021 of how we would address the concerns raised by NAMI and Aspire Minnesota, and how we're going to pay for those room and board costs, because once they're exempted from that family first requirements and they're not compliant, they would not receive 4E payments. So we need to come up with a recommendation and information about exactly what that impact would be. So I just said a lot. I'm more than willing to answer any questions you might have.
All right. Before we take questions, I would like to let Mrs. Abderholden testify from NAMI.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. I do appreciate the fact that the department did sit down with us after that hearing. We worked hard going through all the language, so we are not opposing the bill today, but I really want to make sure that legislators understand that it's because of the Federal Family First Act, it's nearly impossible to actually address all of our concerns. And so we are pleased that there will be a stakeholder group that will come together. You know, I know Minnesota has a reputation of trying to find every federal dollar we can to pay for things, but I think in this situation that we are really looking in the future to harming families who have a child with a serious mental illness by really kind of forcing them to go back through the child protection system, you know, doing the relative search, doing all those types of things. So I really hope that you know, during this interim period, we come back with a good solution, which is not to take Title IV-E dollars for these families, and that you really take this take these recommendations next year seriously, because again, I think the department has done what they can to address our concerns, but a lot of the problems, frankly, are with the federal law and with our use of Title IV-E dollars for this. So again, we're not opposing this at this time because a lot of those, they did what they could, but we look forward to next year and making some real change in this area.
Well, thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Thank you all for your testimony. Do we have any questions? All right, so just want to thank you all for coming together. Members, we will convene next Wednesday to take additional public testimony and to vote on amendments and passage for this bill. The committee 24-hour rules are still in place. And if we don't have any other questions, I would just like to say that we are officially adjourned.